The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the acclaimed historian Peter Cousins. The former decorated Foreign Service officer has written or edited 16 books on the American Civil War and the Indian Wars of the American West. His previous book, The Earth is Weeping, about the latter subject, received the Bancroft Prize, and now he turns his sights to the Indian Wars at the beginning of the 19th century. Tecumseh, at least to most non-Indian Oklahomans, is known mostly as a town in the state. But the man it was named for was a rare man able to assemble tribes all over the Midwest in the first decades of the 1800s into the largest assemblage of Indians ever to oppose the Western European-American expansion into what is now the upper Midwest. Tecumseh was an effective leader in battle, an eloquent orator defending Indian rights and land, and a diplomat and a strategic figure who negotiated alliances with a variety of tribes as well as the British. In Cousins' new book, Tecumseh also relied heavily on his younger brother, Tezcuatawa, known as the Shawnee Prophet, a mystic who had previously been discounted in history. Their partnership is at the heart of his new book, Tecumseh and the Prophet, The Shawnee Brothers Who Defied a Nation. It's published by Knopf. Peter Cousins, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich. I really appreciate it.
You know, a little over 60 years before the gathering of Lakota and Northern Cheyenne, when they gathered to resist the U.S. Army in Montana and Wyoming, putting an end to George Custer, an even larger confederacy of Indians gathered to resist European Americans' westward expansion into the upper Midwest, what was then known as the Northwest. Why do we know so much about the former and so little about the latter?
That's a very good question. I think because, as you said, you know, the confederation of Indians under Tecumseh and his brother, who opposed the Western American movement in the old Northwest, was actually the largest that the United States ever faced in its history. And, you know, I think the reason for that is largely due to popular culture, popular literature, everything from John Ford Westerns to the enduring fascination with the Little Bighorn and Custer's demise. And I think, you know, it was Hollywood that glommed onto the, you know, the fascination of depicting the Indians on horseback chasing buffalo. And of course, a very different culture than the Indians east of the Mississippi possessed. But as you say correctly, you know, the conflicts east of the Mississippi and north of the Ohio River and west of the Appalachians and today's modern Midwest were far more bloody and far more decisive than those west of the Mississippi, and really made what happened in the American West almost a fait accompli.
This was the real battle for the continent then in the upper Midwest.
It really was, because the first road to the west was the Ohio Valley and the Ohio River. And so it was a battle in part for the Great Lakes and also for the Ohio River. And that was the way that Americans went west in the early days of the settlement west of the Appalachians. So that was the first door, so to speak, to the American West.
And for a few years, the Shawnees, led by Tecumseh, actually closed down the Ohio River.
Off and on, they did. It was, uh-huh. And it was not just the Shawnee. It was some of the other neighboring tribes who allied themselves with the Shawnee. But particularly in Tecumseh's earlier days as an adolescent and young warrior, indeed, Shawnee war parties would strike the Ohio River, strike the flatboats of settlers that were traveling along the Ohio River, pillaging them, killing the settlers, and at times completely shutting down the traffic.
It's interesting, before we get into the story of Tecumseh, you know, I've heard his name so many different ways. Here in Oklahoma, where we have a band of Shawnees that were resettled in Oklahoma, and the town name for him, we say Tecumseh. But I've heard so many people refer to him as Tecumseh. Do we know what the correct pronunciation of his name is?
Well, yes and no. And this is the same problem we have with his brother, Tezcuatawa. I've seen various pronunciations suggested. Of course, names are pronounced differently over time and evolve. But what I consider the most authoritative pronunciation of Tecumseh was given by a 12-year-old boy, Kentuckian, who was captured by the Shawnee and raised with Tecumseh, lived with him for 17 years, became his closest friend, and spoke both Shawnee and English fluently. And he, in fact, wrote it out in a memoir phonetically, and he said that the Shawnees pronounce his name, and I'll try to do it as much justice as I can, Tecumseh, with a, kind of a TH sound at the end. He suggested that pronunciation was too difficult for most non-Native Americans, and who just simplified it as Tecumseh, just kind of lazily.
Well, now, what led you to write about Tecumseh and his brother, Tinskwatawa? You know, they led this confederacy of tribes against the American army that was trying to open up the Northwest territory. What led you to this particular story? I know you've written numerous histories about the American West and Western Indians and the Civil War. What led you to this particular story?
Well, I mean, after completing my book on the Indian Wars of the American West, Earth is Weeping, I gradually came to realize that I was not telling a very important part of the story, you know, the prologue, so to speak, the American conquest of the modern Midwest and upper Great Lakes, which was by no means a foregone conclusion. And as I discussed in the book, Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa, they could very easily have succeeded with the help of their British allies and won a free Indian state, so to speak, as a buffer between Canada and the United States. And had that happened, we would have, you know, Michigan would have been an Indian buffer state, perhaps Wisconsin. It could have changed the entire map of the northern boundary of the United States for at least a generation and seriously impeded westward migration. So it was an incredibly significant story, what happened writ large. Again, you know, they also created the largest Indian confederation Americans ever faced. And I was fascinated initially by Tecumseh because he is, you know, an iconic leader, Indian leader. But then I was drawn in as much, if not more so, by his brother, Tenskwatawa, who was the religious and spiritual creator of this Indian revitalization movement that Tecumseh then converted into a political military alliance. So there were the spiritual and cultural aspects of the phenomenon of the creation of this alliance intrigued me as much, if not in some ways more so, than Tecumseh's principally military and political alliance.
Was Tinskwatawa a mystic of some sort, or?
Yes, I would characterize him as really the, you know, there's in Native American history and tradition, there's a great tradition of seers and prophets, of those who claim to be able to communicate with the great spirit or the master of life, the master of breath, what we refer to as God, and who could not only communicate directly with them, but could bring messages back to their people from the creator. And the Indians, you know, had a great deal of faith and belief in many of these prophets. And Tenskwatawa, he built on a tradition of this, but he was without a doubt the most influential prophet in Native American history by far. And the way he came to become a prophet was in itself fascinating. He was, as a young man, he was the polar opposite of Tecumseh, who was seen from birth destined to great things. Tecumseh was a excellent hunter, great warrior. He's a very handsome man. He was very charismatic. Even as an adolescent, he drew many young warriors to his side. He was just a natural leader. Whereas Tenskwatawa, who was one of three triplets born to his mother, was from the start a misfit, a ne'er-do-well. As a young boy, he shot his right eye out with an arrow. As a young man, he became addicted to alcohol. He was an alcoholic from his late teens. And alcoholism was one of the things that plagued the Indian tribes in that region and really weakened, debilitated their societies. But he was an absolute lay-around, dissolute. He relied on Tecumseh as a young man and on his brother-in-law, his own brother-in-law, to provide him and his two wives with the sustenance they needed to maintain themselves. He was a failure as a shaman. And then one night in 1805, when he was contemplating the lot of Indians in the Midwest, which was then appeared to be cultural disillusion, alcoholism, poverty, encroachment by the whites, he had a near-death trance. And he awoke after 2 days. He awoke from this trance. In fact, it was so deep that Tecumseh and his friends thought he had died, and they were preparing to bury him. And he awoke from this, and he spoke of this, of having visited the master of life and the afterlife, and saw the potential damnation that Indians faced if they did not return to their more traditional ways. And from that day, he turned from being an alcoholic to becoming not only abstemious, but an incredibly articulate and charismatic preacher of a return to a more traditional Indian way of life. It was a remarkable turnaround.
And that turnaround involved eschewing alcohol, eschewing Western dress, and anything having to do with European Americans.
Not entirely. There was a pragmatic element to Teng Fatawa's doctrine. He saw Americans as really more the enemies of the Indians, and he equated them to scum being driven onto the shore from the Atlantic, and being almost a separate level of humanity beneath that of the Indians, but not so the British. The British in Canada, he recognized, as well as his brother and other Indians in the Midwest, that the British in Canada were their best guarantors against American inroads. The British supplied them with provisions when needed, with arms and ammunition. And so he put the British and the French in a different class. And while he called upon the Indians to eschew contact with Americans and also most aspects of Western technology as it was at the time, that didn't include muskets or ammunition, which he realized were, of course, essential to Indian defense. So there was a strong element of pragmatism in his doctrine as well.
What was his role in forming the Confederacy? Because I think most accounts of Tenskwatawa have thought of him as somewhat of a charlatan. You know, he had this vision. He helped organize the Confederacy, but, you know, he was basically exposed as a huckster and fraudster. And after the battle that we know as Tippecanoe, he was not believed anymore.
Yeah, none of that is true. That's all myth. He created the Confederacy and was able to attract followers from far and wide, from as far away as northernmost Wisconsin and Michigan, northern Ohio, northern Indiana, which parts of the modern-day states that were still in Indian possession, from across Illinois and as far out as modern-day Iowa, with his call, for a religious and social revitalization of Indians. And so his doctrine held a great appeal to Indians who felt adrift and felt that they were losing their traditional way of life before this gradual but seemingly inexorable onslaught of Americans. And things that he preached, some of them, such as a extirpation of witches, for instance, among the Indians, absolutely repelled whites. I mean, and they thought it was, barbaric, it was savage, it was beyond their understanding. You know, I guess most Americans had forgotten the Salem witch trials of just 100 and some years earlier. But these calls on the part of Teng Fatawa were very much in line with the traditions and the beliefs of these tribes. In fact, by way of digression, as late as the turn of the 20th century, there were Shawnees in Oklahoma and Kansas who were still speaking of witchcraft as an evil among the Shawnees. So this had a long and deep tradition among the Indians. And it was easy for Americans to dismiss him and consider him a charlatan because, his solution to the Indian woes was so foreign to anything that Americans could understand, whereas Tecumseh's sort of evolution of the alliance toward a more political military response was more understandable because it's something that white Americans would do if they were faced with a similar situation. And speaking of Tippecanoe, and this is one of the things that surprised me as I did my research and really dove into the primary sources, Tippecanoe was not, it was not an Indian defeat. As William Henry Harrison, who battled Tenskwatawa at Tippecanoe and succeeded in burning the village, he did this for political reasons, to further his own political career. There was really no intrinsic reason for him to have initiated this battle, which he fought on land that was, by treaty, belonged to the Indians. But he ended up stirring up a hornet's nest. He was able to convince Washington that he had won Washington, D.C., that he had won a great victory, when, in fact, beyond burning Prophetstown, the village that the Shawnee brothers had as their headquarters, so to speak, for their alliance, and which they subsequently rebuilt, he started this incredible hornet's nest, and he ended up bringing to the cause of the Shawnee brothers many, many hundreds, if not thousands, more warriors than otherwise would have joined the alliance, because they saw that, you know, this unwarranted provocation on the part of Harrison as sort of a precursor to what might happen to them if they didn't resist. So tribes in Wisconsin and Michigan and eastern Minnesota, who really hadn't felt encroachment from Americans as of yet, they realized that, you know, gee, the handwriting is sort of on the wall here if we don't join up with Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa. So, and Tenskwatawa, he continued to be influential after Tippecanoe. He was forced into the battle. He had his back up against the wall when Harrison appeared before his village. He was asked by his followers to make some divine magic to help them achieve victory, and, you know, he did some divination, and which failed. But he was not blamed for that in the long term, because what really defeated the Indians and over which he had no control was a relative lack of ammunition.
Yeah, they ran out of ammunition.
They ran out of bullets. they were holding their own. In fact, they inflicted, relatively speaking, heavier casualties on Harrison than he did on the Indians, but they couldn't fight without bullets, and so they gradually were forced to retreat. And some did hold Tenskwatawa temporarily responsible. You know, why did your magic fail? Why weren't we able to prevail? And he said, well, that one of his wives had been menstruating and touched a utensil that he in turn touched. And by Indian tradition, a menstruating woman, if she came in contact with a holy man or something that was regarded as sacred, it negated the power of that. And that was accepted. So Tenskwatawa, as the alliance became more, again, after Tippecanoe, it took a more military, political turn because of the need to resist the Americans militarily, and particularly after the War of 1812 broke out and the British courted the Tecumseh and his followers actively, he was never sidelined. In fact, he led one of the battles that the alliance fought against the Americans in the War of 1812. While Tecumseh was up in Michigan and western Canada, he fought a battle against Fort Harrison in Indiana. So he was not a particularly successful war leader, but he was never supplanted the way history would have us believe.
My guest today is Peter Cousins, a historian and a Civil War and Western historian. His latest book is titled Tecumseh and the Prophet, The Shawnee Brothers Who Defied a Nation. It's published by Knopf. We've talked about Tenskwatawa, who had a more important role than what most popular histories have given him, and according to you. But Tecumseh is this warrior, this diplomat, this amazing orator that rallied various tribes to his cause. What do we need to know about Tecumseh?
Well, you know, on a human level, one of the things that I most enjoyed discovering as I came to know him was that he was a really nice guy. I mean, a really genuinely fine person. I mean, imagine when he was a boy, from his childhood to his early adolescence, his village were forced to move deeper into Ohio three times because they were attacked by Kentuckians, by the Kentucky militia. And from his childhood on, he saw almost ceaseless bloodshed caused by Americans and inflicted upon the Shawnee. yet he remained an extremely humane man by any standards. For instance, torture of male prisoners was considered to be not only acceptable, but also a matter of routine among the woodland tribes, the Shawnee and related tribes. He opposed torture on principle. He was vehemently opposed to it. He was opposed to making war on women and children. He was an extreme, like I said earlier, extremely charismatic man, even from his youth. And despite the bad experiences he had with Kentuckians early on and into his 20s, once peace was made in 1794, he became very good friends with a number of his Ohio neighbors, Ohio settlers, and was known by them to have a great sense of humor, to wrestle with them and to engage in games with them. You know, he was a man who would not fight unless his back was up against the wall. He was not intrinsically warlike. And it's a very engaging character.
And you actually include a couple of times in the book William Henry Harrison's assessment of Tecumseh, which was really, he was also, even though he opposed him in battle, he thought very highly of him.
Oh, absolutely. I think William Henry Harrison was governor of the Indiana Territory, which for a good part of the time of which we're speaking, actually incorporated almost the entire Midwest, most of Illinois and most of Ohio for a number of years before it was reduced in size. But nonetheless, Harrison negotiated the treaties between 1803 and 1809 that took from the Indians the better part of their Midwestern homelands. And in 1811, after trying to push yet another treaty over on the Indians, despite the emphatic resistance of Tecumseh, who said, "We've given you this much, we've gone this far, but no farther," after a particularly contentious council with Tecumseh, he wrote a letter to the Secretary of War in which he said that, and I'm paraphrasing it, he said in part that Tecumseh was one of these, as he said, uncommon geniuses who arise from time to time throughout history, and if it were not for the presence of the United States, he easily could rise to the level of the emperor of a domain similar to Aztec Mexico or Indian Peru. Harrison had tremendous respect for Tecumseh and his charisma and ability to win over followers and keep them by his side. And he had a similarly high regard for Tenskwatawa earlier on until he realized that Tenskwatawa had a tendency to double deal with Harrison.
Now, in Tecumseh's final years, he fights with the British
right.
in the War of 1812. He wins a great victory at Detroit. He captures Detroit. They're forced to abandon that later when Commodore Perry wins the Battle of Lake Erie, and he fights in Canada, and eventually he dies in a battle along the Thames in Canada. And what do you think would have happened if he had survived that conflict? Would anything have turned out different?
Things would have turned out differently only had the British been able to reinforce their troops in Western Canada. I kind of attribute the defeat of Tecumseh and his alliance, which at its apogee reached 6,000 warriors, which was three times as many as Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse amassed against Custer and the Little Bighorn, which was the largest Indian alliance ever created in the American West. What defeated Tecumseh and his alliance and his British allies in the upper Midwest and along the Great Lakes and in Western Ontario, what was then Western Canada, was actually Napoleon Bonaparte. Mm-hmm. The British preoccupation with fighting Napoleon on the continent in Europe prevented them from being able to send enough troops to Canada to sufficiently defend the entire province against the Americans. Yet, with only 900 troops in Western Canada, in Western Ontario, the British, in conjunction with their Indian allies, were able to hold the Americans at bay, not only to capture Detroit and in the process capture the entire American army in the Midwest, but to hold their own up until the Battle of Lake Erie. If the British had been able to send just another regiment, perhaps another 1,000 men, west to reinforce their command that was allied with Tecumseh and the Indians, I think it's very, very likely they would have prevailed because of the general ineptitude of Americans in the War of 1812 and that had been demonstrated by Indian and British victories early on. And Tecumseh himself recognized that the fragility of his alliance, that in it, to hold it together, he needed a demonstration on the part of the British that they were capable of delivering on their promise that in exchange for the Indians fighting with them, they would fight to enable the Indians to create a homeland of their own that would, at a minimum, consist of modern-day Michigan and Wisconsin and perhaps even a good part of northern Ohio and northern Indiana. The British made that promise to the Indians. That's why the Indians fought with them. But Tecumseh realized that if there were not enough British soldiers fighting alongside the Indians would come to doubt that commitment, besides being militarily weakened thereby. And so if the British had been able to reinforce both their navy on the Great Lakes and defeated Stephen Perry, which was doable if they'd given the attention to it, and if they'd been able to commit a few more troops to that theater, things could have been very different. Tecumseh could have succeeded. Michigan, at a minimum, Michigan could have become an Indian buffer state between Canada and the United States, which the British very much wanted. And it could have changed, again, reshaped the entire northern boundary of the Midwest for at least a generation. Now, had Tecumseh survived, but the British been defeated nonetheless, I think it would have been a very sad end that he would have faced, because by the time of his defeat at the Battle of Thames, all but 500 of his nearly 6,000 warriors had broken away from him. I mean, they were not fighting for Canada, were not fighting for the British to maintain Canada. And the deeper that the British retreated into Canada and away from Michigan, the less the Indians were inclined to follow them and fight for them. Tecumseh continued to because he thought it was his best remaining opportunity. But had he survived the defeat, I think he would have found himself a very lonely and bitter man, unfortunately.
A very tragic end.
Very tragic end. Instead of the really tragic also, but more heroic end that he came to at the Battle of the Thames.
The name of the book is Tecumseh and the Prophet, The Shawnee Brothers Who Defied a Nation. Peter Cousins, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Peter Cousins speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Tecumseh and the Prophet, The Shawnee Brothers Who Defied a Nation. It's published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.